that was like the start of the hard part for me, because I was pre-med and I did a poetry writing workshop with a poet named Lucy Brock Broido, and she was really encouraging. And then I went home and I basically had to like come out to my parents.
Yeah.
And it was like
the poetry closet.
Yeah, it was a big deal for them. I remember like the kitchen at night, we're around the table and my mom crying and, you know, saying, you're going to become one of those people who rides a bicycle around with elbow patches on their jacket.
Wait, that's like the goal, right?
I know, and I was like, yeah, that's yes. The idea. Yeah. But I, you know.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom? Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past. I'm Stephen Lovely, director of the Iowa Young Writers Studio.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, the senior editor at the Writing University.
And I'm Danny Colacci, director of the Magid Center for Writing here at the University of Iowa. And listeners, today we're going to finally answer the question everyone has been asking, what's in the box? To help us get there, we are joined in studio by poet, editor, human extraordinaire, the one and only Srikanth Reddy. Reddy is the author of three books of poetry, including Facts for Visitors, Voyager, and Underworld Lit, which was a finalist for the Griffin International Poetry Prize, a book of criticism, and a brand new book of lectures entitled The Unsignificant, Three Talks on Poetry and Pictures. Reddy is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, the recipient of honors from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts, among others, and he currently serves as the poetry editor for the Paris Review and the series editor for the University of Chicago Press's Phoenix Poets series. Now, about that box. Maybe all poets wonder how it's done, how a true master craftsman makes a thing so solid and vast it both contains the possibility to hold the quite real, never-ending universe of emotion and thought, while also maintaining the structural fortitude to ensure all that possibility can itself withhold the weight it seems to need to carry. Maybe it's not just poets. Maybe it's the readers of poetry, those merry few believers, who view the box they find in their hands and say to themselves, my God, look at this stunning sundial. Time is a mouth, a function of the glorious unknown. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not all poets or readers. I'm just one poetry reader who, since I first had the luxury of reading the work of Srikanth Reddy over 20 years ago, has asked myself time and again, not how he builds his poems, those unmatched language frames, but rather what tools and tricks he doesn't deploy to steal my heart anew. Listener, if there's a more precise, vetted architect of electric verse, I don't know of them. Reddy writes with heart and ear, with formal air and care, and also careful abandon. From collapsed villanelles to repaced erasures, Srikanth Reddy is a poet who doesn't build boxes as much as he builds their objective correlative. Lines and stanzas, sequences and books, giving any reader lucky enough to hold these words the chance to realize it was never what was in the box that mattered. It wasn't even a box. It was the knowledge that someone could make us feel the box, need the box, want the box, all of that and more the box, that guides this reader to the claim that Srikanth Reddy is a master of the craft with a heart of gold to boot. It is with honor and joy that we welcome today to Sad Me of the Past, the man of my dreams, Srikanth Reddy.
Welcome. Welcome, Srikanth.
Well done, guys. Danny. Got time as a mouth in there.
I wanted to make you laugh, Lauren.
What's that from?
Oh, he made it up.
Yeah.
But we use it as an inside joke. It's actually a pretty good line of poetry, I think.
It is.
Yeah, guys, I'm not just a podcast host. How many times do I have to tell you that?
So much more. Yeah.
Chiku, welcome. Welcome back to Iowa City. Welcome home. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm I'm hoping that, Lauren, you can edit out the sound of me, my mouth swallowing time.
I've already had so
saliva.
Much practice with Stephen. Stephen has really
training
bad mouth
her,
sounds.
Yeah,
so.
I do. That's why, you know, when I'm not talking, I back up.
Okay. Yeah. My daughter once told me that when I chew and it sounds like a horse.
I believe her.
So, Lauren, you want to tell Chiku a little bit about this podcast?
All right. So I came up with this podcast a long time ago and tried to recruit many different people to do it with me.
And she got to the bottom of the list.
These two schlubs finally said yes. Mm-hmm. The idea was, like I was telling you, I went through a box of my own writing and I found, you know, not only did I find like embarrassment of embarrassments and riches, but I also had like an emotional journey. And I thought it'd be really cool to see like other writers who I respect and admire and love, were they writing this bad of stuff in elementary school? And it'd be nice for younger writers to see, like, look, you do get better. No one comes out writing amazingly. Unfortunately,
I think what we've learned is like
everyone that comes on brings their supposed.
We're still waiting for someone who doesn't.
And
write
it's all
well at
amazing.
The age of 16. Yeah,
and so I've just had to let that concept of that show go.
Yeah.
And now we're fascinated in seeing what we've noticed is a lot of times what you were writing when you were a kid is what you're writing now.
Uh-huh.
The same things that you were grappling with.
Yeah.
You're grappling now. And I think Josh Parkinson said it really well. He was like, I had to go way out to come back to the thing I was trying to do at seven, you know?
But we're not forcing you into an arc, Chiku. You don't have to,
you don't have to follow
If your
that.
Story is different, don't feel like you have to conform to Lauren's, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm remembering, like, now I'm like, around. Oh, man, I should have brought my my first poem, which does exist somewhere, and it's illustrated.
Can you recite it?
I can tell you what it's an acrostic.
Yes.
Great.
Nice.
And it's and so I can recite it from the first letter going down. And it's just two words. Abraham Lincoln.
Oh.
Wait, that's
I mean, it's
you're
a start.
Spelling those out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you remember? So do you remember
the whole what the poem did?
Do you remember where you were and what you?
Yeah, yeah.
Like what? How did? What was the context?
Yeah. So it was like probably like fourth grade or something, and I was really into Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
He was like the superhero. You know, because you know, I grew up in Chicago. There's a super cult of Abraham Lincoln in the state of Illinois public education system.
I was
learning about, you know, his whole life story. He was tall. He was strong. He freed the slaves.
Pretty good hero.
And so, like, we had an assignment to do an acrostic poem. And I'm like, well, obviously, Abraham Lincoln is that's where I'm going.
The root of all
everyone's
poetry.
Everyone's going to do it.
Yeah. And I don't remember what all I remember is that they were individual words. So it was just like the first, like, line was like, awesome. And the next one was like, brave.
I have it written up here.
Badass.
I've set up the acrostic.
You know, yeah. Rad. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was just like descriptive words.
Yeah. Just positive adjectives associated with Abraham Lincoln. And there was a drawing. You know, there's a drawing of him with his top hat smiling out at you.
If you can find that, I'd love to get a picture of
that. I'll try and dig it up. Yeah.
Do you remember who was the teacher who gave you this fourth grade acrostic poem assignment?
That's it must have been Miss Caden. And, you know, I don't remember much about the context, but that's my first political poem. I really stuck my neck out.
What a stance to take, too.
Pro Lincoln.
I'd like to take it all the way back then, because you just mentioned not only Abraham Lincoln, but you also mentioned you grew up in Chicago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's start there.
I agree.
So you're born in Chicago,
raised.
Born and raised. And at what point Is it before this fourth grade assignment or is it after this fourth grade assignment? Do you start gravitating towards writing, reading, literature? Was it something that you just always had kind of an interest in, or do you remember when it sort of became a thing for you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I really came to writing poetry till later. Like I have like the, you know, the school assignment of doing a haiku and, you know, I think I probably enjoyed it as much as the next kid. But
was it Abraham Lincoln?
Haiku? Yeah. No, I think there was like one about like flying a kite in the wind. It's yeah.
You Can know, this be your next usual. Book though? This
just one Abraham, except like expanded, yes. like exploded view of Abraham Lincoln. Yeah.
Sorry, great title for the book, too, Exploded View of Abraham. Yeah. yeah.
But I was, like, totally immersed in reading because I, both my parents worked full-time jobs. They were physicians. They just immigrated from India. And so they were like, at work. And they didn't have, like, great, you know, they had the kind of crappy details that, like, the American-born doctors didn't have. In fact, my mom had trained as a OB-GYN in India, and she was catching babies in a town in India called Tirupati, and that was her dream job. She really loved it. And then when they came to the U.S., there weren't jobs like that for her, so she had to switch and retrain, and she became a radiation oncologist. Working in a Veterans Administration hospital.
Wow.
So basically from catching babies to...
To the you know, opposite.
Yeah, ushering Korean War veterans, you know, on their way out. Like people who'd been exposed to Agent Orange and, you know. So they were like working all the time. And I and my sister were on our own. And so we get dropped off at daycare early or dropped off at school early. And we were latchkey kids and would come home and there would be hours before they came home. And so I read a lot because I wasn't like super sporty kid. And, you know, I think my mom says I learned how to read from I watched a lot of TV too. Mm-hmm. And I guess I learned to read from watching Sesame Street and was reading, you know, just like all the time. So that's kind of where literary language kind of opened up because I remember this kind of like golden age of like school books. And there were these, I would get dropped off at this daycare. Actually, it was our first school. Kindergarten was a Lutheran school where the only things you could do were, you know, plunk out like Jesus Loves Me on the piano, or read Bible stories, wow. you know, Bible comics and stuff.
Do you remember what were some of the things that you read that you remember really being meaningful to you? Can you remember that early, or was there anything in particular that stands out?
Yeah. I would read like, so one thing about this kindergarten was they went up through the different grades, and so they had like textbooks. They were called like Golden Stories or something like that. It was like textbooks of different stories for different grades. And so I just like would work my way through these books before school because we would have like a whole hour and there would be no end. The teacher didn't want to deal with us. So I remember then like after that, reading, like there were this series that I don't know when you guys were little, was there a series called Great Books?
Yeah, there were, and it had like, I remember the letters were blue. This is, didn't it have like this, it said Great Books like stamped on the cover of each of the different covers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And they weren't books. They were just short stories.
Oh, right. Okay.
But they're classics.
And they're like paperback, right? Mm-hmm. Like cheaply made.
And there would be stories by like Maupassant or like Robert Louis Stevenson. So I still remember a story called The Most Dangerous Game.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that one?
I think I do.
Well, that story's horrifying. Don't they hunt a human?
Yeah.
On an island?
Yeah.
They made a movie out of it.
And like, that was pure fiction back then, but I don't know.
There's definitely reality TV.
Okay.
you know, the thing about like that story or the like Ray Bradbury stories that, you know, were in those collections were there was a lot of scary stories.
Yeah.
I remember those collections too. There were a lot of like dramatic nature. Mm-hmm. I remember one about people being overrun by ants, Leninger and the ants or something. And then there was Jack London's, there was one about him freezing to death.
How to Start a Fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I remember having an anthology with all these stories and just being like, God, are these like, you know, this is what they give kids first, like to read.
Yeah. But it was an amazing like theater of the imagination. And it was like, there was nothing that could compare to like the most dangerous game where this guy is shipwrecked on an island and he sees this castle and he seeks shelter and he's welcomed in by this magnanimous host and then learns that he's going to be hunted that night. And, you know, spoiler alert, at the end of that story, the hunter becomes the hunted. You know, and it ends with like an open-ended, like you don't know who's going to be the prey. And that...
It comes up a lot, too. Did you ever read like Reader's Digest or...
Yeah, okay. Totally.
And those stories were scary, too.
Yeah, they were scary. And then there was like sex stuff in Reader's Digest, too.
Really?
You know, like sex advice and things, and it's like
I shouldn't be reading.
I don't remember that. How did I miss that?
Yeah. Stephen, maybe your parents tore the sex.
I was reading too much Humor in Uniform.
I forgot about that.
So how did you? Yeah. So did you? Did you ever write fiction? Like, did you ever have an instinct to write prose?
I don't think so. I had like all of you, I'm sure, like total inexhaustible appetite and hunger for narrative. But I did, I did write quite a few stories and, you know, would bind them. And I don't think I saw your little copyright on, The Lost Island. What was it called again?
It was called The Lost Island, yeah, and I copyrighted it, you know, by just drawing a sea and then a circle around it.
With a little teddy bear next to the sea.
Yeah, I was going to start my own, I don't know, teddy bear copywriting agency. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But like, it's like that, like, when I saw that, I felt like I knew where you were, you know, because like, also, there was a name for the publishing company, Troll Books.
Yeah. No, I was starting an empire, you guys.
Yeah.
You got to do it all yourself these days.
You do when you're a kid.
But so Chiku, so you're reading a bunch, your parents are working, you're watching TV, and you got a sibling at home. And as you're kind of making your way through elementary school, were you like reading at night and your parents couldn't take your books away? Or were you really only kind of doing it when you had nothing else to do? And how did that then start to intersect with what you were doing either academically or just in your spare time? Like, did you start to see these things focus in a space where you were like, I want to do this for my life?
So I was reading all through the summers, riding my bike, going to the public library, just staying in the library all day. And then, you know, and that was all through like grade school. And then, you know, high school got kind of more social and, you know, started sitting on the bench at basketball games, and, you know. I think I did feel like I wanted to have writing at the center of what I did because I felt like that was the thing that had nourished me for a long time. And, you know, a lot of it was also growing up as like a South Asian kid in a totally like white Irish Catholic kind of suburb of Chicago once we moved to the suburbs after I was six. And being a little embarrassed that my mom and dad didn't speak English perfectly and childishly blaming them for not fully mastering another totally foreign language while they were also becoming physicians. And so like really, really having a mastery of English was like something I like fixated on. So like spelling bees were like a big deal.
Oh, I bet you were good at them.
I was really good at spelling bees.
I knew it.
I, in fact, it got to the point where I remember I threw a spelling bee
what?
In eighth grade.
Oh, really?
Why?
Yeah.
What's
were you being paid?
How did that come
it
about?
It was just like I was like in the middle of like that was the one thing I could always win at, and I like lost it so much else, you know, on a regular basis. I just started to feel really deeply. I remember feeling in the middle of the spelling bee. Being like embarrassed because like no one else wanted to be in the spelling bee, but everyone had to be in the spelling bee every year, and feeling like, you know, I've won a lot of these spelling bees. I'm going to win this one. So, but I had to make it look realistic so I couldn't misspell like.
What was the word?
Butter, you know, I couldn't misspell an easy word.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had to wait until I got a word that I could maybe realistically not spell.
Wow.
And it was shepherd.
Oh,
that's a hard one. I can't spell it right now.
See, that sounds stressful just waiting for the word.
Are there two H's in it?
No, it's H-H-A-R-D. Is that right?
Does it start?
H-E-R-D. Sorry. I'm a bad speller.
And he's not even trying.
I'm so nervous about saying the wrong thing.
I'm not.
Wait, but was this out of like empathy for the other students that you?
Yeah.
It was not wanting to be the nerd, you know,
and
that's also a cultural thing. Like, you know, look at who wins the spelling bees, you know, it's always the South Asian kid.
So you were trying to throw it for some popularity or to shore
to
up.
To be less unpopular.
I get it. Yeah.
Did you have like a. Did you like turn on your acting chops? Like, were you like pretending?
Like, oh man,
yeah. pretending.
S H E P P E R D, and then like the look on Mr. Bolton's face was like, oh my god,
so disappointed. Knew? Yeah,
I don't think he. I don't know. Actually, he might have known, and like it's like you know another Asian kid won so.
Okay.
But it wasn't like, you at least.
It wasn't me. It wasn't me. So then, like, someone else got to be king of the spelling nerds.
Right,
But so, you were reading so much, and you're saying that you also like you knew writing was something you wanted to connect to your world. When were you? When did you move from this passion for reading into trying your own hand at writing?
Yeah. So I would like write like stories, you know. As a kid, and then for a little while in grade school, I would write stories, and my teacher would, I think just to kill time, have me read them. And they were always funny stories, and they were funny stories that had like character, like people from the school in them, and something zany happened. And so that became like a class time filler. And I'm just remembering now because I hadn't thought about this for a long time. But so I was always like aware that like writing was something like that would get people's attention, and that you know being creative with it was something that was kind of fun. But I think I wanted to be a journalist in high school. I was reading, you know, like columnists in the Chicago Tribune. I remember there's a guy named Mike Royko who
course,
I thought was,
yeah,
you remember it? Yeah.
Oh, of course.
Are you from Chicago as well?
No, I just, but I, you know, have spent some time there and I know Mike Royko. I think he was syndicated nationally.
Yeah, I think so he was too. Yeah. So I thought like, okay, maybe I'll be, and I was, we were talking earlier, I started writing movie reviews when I was in high school. For the Tribune, because they had this little thing they did for a couple of years where they had a panel of high school movie critics.
Cool.
That was like awesome. It's just like I peaked in like junior high school.
You remember some of the movies you reviewed?
Oh, yeah. We were just talking before about because I could get out of school to go downtown.
Oh.
And, so there was a radio station called WGCI that was like a black radio station in Chicago in the 90s and 80s. And they would have a premiere, and you could, and if you're a GCI listener, you could win tickets to go to the premiere of Predator 2. And then I would, you know, get permission to leave high school and pick up my friend Mark Boddy, who did not have permission to leave his school. And we would go downtown and we'd watch the premiere of Predator 2, you know, in a Southside movie theater. And then I would write some smug
Acrostic.
Yeah.
Right.
Ode to Danny Glover.
Roy Cohen sort of.
Yeah.
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 Amazing.
Yeah.
You were allowed to watch Predator 2?
Yeah, I guess I was not really old enough to. Was that like, was it like 18 for R-rated movies
then? I don't
know.
Well, I still haven't 17, seen it.
17, but I don't, yeah, it sounds yeah. like you were, you found a way in, you know?
Yeah, because like I had the press pass. I had like a Chicago so Tribune cool. press pass, yeah, and I would so go cool. in to the, like, we didn't have email. So I would have to go into the Tribune Tower to file my copy. And I remember once, you know, Gene Siskel, who's a great film critic at the Tribune at the time, I got in an elevator with him.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he hated the teen critics because we were taking like space.
Yeah.
You know,
the youngsters
from him.
Are coming up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Putting the pressure on him.
It's
so
true.
He acted as if he didn't know me.
He was scared.
Yeah, he was terrified. Yeah, yeah,
you were like, yeah. I threw a spelling bee, buddy.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could see his
fear.
The fear in his face.
I can't remember if we actually talked about this on the podcast, but another one of our former guests, Vinny Wilhelm, when he was growing up, he would go see all these movies that he shouldn't have been seeing.
Oh.
And he asked his parents at some point a similar thing, like, you know, why, how did you let me go to those movies? And his dad had thought the rating scale stood for, you know, G, P, G, R, that it was good.
Yeah.
Pretty good. Really good.
Really good.
Which is
X would be extremely good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which
like
isn't
the Criterion
wrong.
Collection is
yeah.
R.
Yeah. It's so interesting because I would, I mean, at this point, it seems to like I would never have guessed that you would go on to be a poet. Like it just seems like you're really prose oriented. You're writing journalism and reviews and
yeah.
But I see like
what
some
happened?
Poems in front of you. Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
Where'd you go wrong?
Were you reading poetry?
Not for pleasure, really.
Okay.
I had an amazing high school teacher. We all probably did, right?
Yes.
It's amazing how often there is some person.
Yeah,
who's like
yeah,
a turn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom Carey, you know, freshman year of high school, Hinsdale Central, and. It was a, you know, advanced English class, and he wasn't like Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. He was like kind of more of like a, more of a cranky pants, but he had us reading Wallace Stevens.
Wow.
You know.
In high school.
Yeah, like early Wallace Stevens from Harmonium. Chief Azcan, if you can, of Caftan and Henna with Heckle's Halt. Like I remember like reading that as a freshman in high school and being like, whoa. So that was, and there's one poem called Disillusionment of 10 O'Clock, Stevens' poem that I remember made me realize that poetry was something that was just something that I had never encountered before.
What was it that that really struck you? Was it the sound or was it
that
rhythm or, you know, was it musical? Or
yeah.
Just everything or?
It was actually the imagination of it. You know, Disillusionment of 10 O'Clock is a short Stevens poem that's about, it's just a list of nightwear that people are not wearing. So, you know, it's like no one is wearing green pajamas with purple stockings or, and then there's a list of just the different colors that people are not wearing to bed. And then at the end, it says, only here and there, a sailor, I think it's an old sailor, drunk in his boots, dreams of catching tigers in red weather.
Red weather.
I can see why you would.
Yeah, and then I was like, and of course, when you're that age, it's like, oh yeah, like, you know, conform.
My life is red weather.
And I'm also like, terrified of wearing like pajamas with green sparkles on them and stuff, but I probably do on some level too.
But it makes a lot of sense hearing you kind of talk about that narrative of your experience where specifically as poetry relates to, you're talking, Stephen, about sound, but also just about the command of the language. And so when you see someone using language in a way that's both imaginative and also hyper-specific, I could imagine a young Chiku who's so interested in the language and seeing something that's both fresh and new and also this thing you've been staring at forever to try to, give yourself the confidence to say, I've mastered this. Here's someone who's kind of using that in an artistic way.
Yeah, yeah. And also it's like, I've been like humble bragging about, you know, reading and spelling and stuff, but I think that was a big reaction formation to feeling like a real sense of unbelonging. And so I could try and write a movie review. I could try and write a story. Those are all ways of trying to find some way of belonging and some way of being like seen. You know, when the teacher's like, okay, Chica, will you read your... Chica's my nickname, right? Chica, will you read your little funny story and make the class laugh, and so I don't have to actually teach this, or will you do the spelling bee or whatever. I think with Stevens, I felt like I saw someone expressing unbelonging and weirdness in language that was not narrative. It wasn't like being used for anything. It was just like a place where I felt like, oh, there's someone out there and I can be close with them.
It's like a cipher and a puzzle suddenly that poetry, I mean, you were so intensely focused on the language and the perfection of the language, and then to run into that where someone's using the language to actually like create obscurity.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't like instrumentalizing language.
Right.
It wasn't using language to win a spelling bee or to write a movie review. It was just the pure pleasure and discovery of it. And so that was a kind of, that was pretty mind-blowing. I didn't start trying to write poems yet, but I was getting interested in them.
Do you remember who else you went on to read after sort of that? Like, you know, any particular poets who you sort of started reading or gravitating towards or stuff?
Yeah, we read Whitman, and that was amazing. But I don't think I was pulling down poetry collections or, you know, really thinking about writing poetry in a real way. I was still kind of maybe messing around with some, like, stories, but it was always for like a high school contest. It wasn't like I was like feeling myself as a writer yet. And then it was college when I fell in love for the first time my freshman year, and you know, was like, okay, I've got to write a poem. This is like the one way I can maybe get a leg up on the competition.
I can't throw the spelling bean to her. So
spelling bee is not going to be that impressive, really.
On the bench,
basketball. Yeah, yeah,
amazing.
Yeah. So you're
just writing bad sonnets.
Do you remember that poem?
You know, I that does not exist anymore. Sure, but I remember, like, you know, there being eyelashes in it.
Good,
yes.
Good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good decision.
Check. Rhymed meter, kind of loose.
Yeah.
Did you? So you're talking about time.
Hours stolen.
Yeah. So you're in high school. You're starting to read poetry, and then you go to college. So somewhere between leaving high school and going to college, you start writing poems in college. So what did you initially go to school for? Were you there thinking, I'm going to major in English and literature or journalism? Or were you like, I'm going to be a doctor?
I was like, Mom and Dad, I'm going to be a doctor. And so, like, you know, I was like the first, I guess, member of my family, you know, to be born in the U.S., and they worked their asses off to, you know, make that happen. And then I went to Harvard, and they're like, you're going to be an anesthesiologist.
The best kind of doctor.
It's not enough just to get into Harvard. You think that would be enough? Like,
yeah. But, you know, it was like they were, for them, like, getting stability, and for them, like, bringing their family over, you know, to America was a large part of their lives. And they were like, you know, okay, you made it. Now you're there. You know, the hard part's over. But that was like the start of the hard part for me, because I was pre-med. And I was also taking lots of English classes, and I did a poetry writing workshop with a poet named Lucy Brock-Broido that was just blew my mind. And she was really encouraging. And then I went home, and I think I was doing like summer school, trying to do chemistry to get my pre-med requirements out, and bombing it and just horsing around and going to the Film Studies Center and watching movies and documentaries and reading poetry. And I basically had to like come out to my parents.
Yeah.
And it was like a...
the poetry closet.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a gradual sort of thing. Was there actually kind of a moment where you were like, hey, this is what I want to do, and then it all hit the fan?
Yeah.
How did it go?
Yeah,
that sounds
yeah.
terrifying to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a big deal for them. I remember like the kitchen at night, we're around the table, and my mom crying, saying... you're going to become one of those people who rides a bicycle around with elbow patches on their jacket.
Wait, that's like the goal, right?
I know, and I was that's the idea.
Yeah, but right.
Elbow patches.
No. It's interesting. When I went to Madison, as you know, Chiku, and when I went to school, I started as a business major.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, no. And when I
still
shifted over to English and creative writing, I remember a similar thing I told my parents and my grandfather.
Your grandfather, too?
And because he was, at the time, my family owned a business, a clothing store. Yeah. And I think there was this idea that I would, like, come back and run the business. It was all on my shoulders.
Yeah.
But when I told them that I was going to move to English and creative writing, they were really supportive, which I'm really grateful for. But I think that part of it was they thought, like, oh, he'll go to law school. And so I was like, I definitely will. And that bought me time. But so in your experience, were you like, I'm going to be a poet and I'm going to go get an MFA and I'm going to write books? Or were you just like, I'm going to major in English and creative writing? Like what did you kind of tell them?
Yeah. I told them that I wanted to become a professor.
Okay, that's where the elbow patches come from.
Yeah. And I was kind of lying because, I think I kind of wanted
to. That was smart, yeah.
I wanted the elbow patches. I wanted the bike. I didn't want to be like an unemployed poet, So I was like, I can become a professor. I have professors who teach this, and you wait and see. I can do it. And my dad was like really understanding, and he was kind of like, okay, well, we'll help you do this.
Oh, that's great.
And my mom also was supportive, but she was in tears.
Yeah.
And I was like, guys, let's just see.
Yeah.
And then I started doing more writing classes and focused on and I stopped doing the pre-med. And that was a huge relief.
Yeah, I bet. When I graduated from the workshop, my parents came and my brothers and my dad, we were driving back from like wherever the graduation, and he was like, so what's the plan? And I was like, well, Cole Swenson was a bartender for 10 years while she wrote. And my dad was like, you need health insurance. He was like, it comes down to health insurance.
Yeah.
And I was pissed that they even asked.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I run a summer writing program for high school students.
Yeah.
And so many of the students who come to the program are looking ahead sort of in their at their college years, and they're looking at that same kind of showdown, and they're they want to know how to manage it. Like, this is kind of what I want to do, but I think I'm going to be pressured by my parents to do this. And how do I negotiate it? How do I go to college and study writing while at the same time satisfying this need that, I feel obligated to do for my parents to sort of do something more practical? And it's a huge concern. I think students really, really worry about it. And so, it's nice to hear it's nice to hear a story where you kind of just came out with it and it went pretty well, all things
considered. It went well. It was, I still get grief. My folks are still kind of like, well, look at Prashant. He became an anesthesiologist. I have the same effect on people as an anesthesiologist.
Yeah,
I have better hours.
Yeah, I remember seeing some movie. I think it was a documentary about Woody Allen traveling around the world, and there's a scene where he's with his parents, and he's like been presented with the key to the city of Venice, and it's the end of his career, and he's at the table, and his dad just says, "You should have been a pharmacist," or whatever it is, it's something like that. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah,
to see
my dad constantly called called the writer's workshop the reader's workshop. And he'd be like, so I told my friend you're in the reader's workshop, and they hadn't heard of it. And I was like, yeah, they haven't heard of the reader's workshop.
Of course they haven't.
Great. Well, speaking of the reader's workshop, so between your switch in majors and starting to write, and eventually you will go to the writer's workshop, but between then, I believe you wrote these poems that are sitting in front of you.
Oh, yeah.
So can you set us up a little bit? When did you write what you're about to read? What do you remember about that time or what you were thinking about? Anything you can share with us before we read them?
Yeah, yeah. So I was writing in college, oftentimes in like a creative writing class. That first teacher was Lucy Brock Broido, but then I had some other really amazing teachers like Henri Cole and Louise Glick came and taught. That was wild. I used to drive her to the grocery store.
That's the best.
In my car that we painted a lightning bolt on the side of it.
Wait, what color was the car? What color was the lightning bolt?
You and who painted it?
It was my, I shared that car we purchased for $500. It was a old Chevy, like Impala, that was painted black, and we painted a yellow lightning bolt crudely on the driver's side door. And we had a really stupid kind of little lingo where we were convinced that we were going to make the word touch into a kind of like part of like, you know, the slang of our generation. So if anything was cool, it was touch.
Oh, let's start it now.
I like it.
Yeah. So these, I'm going to read some touch poems.
Yeah.
Right.
I tried to get the word brill going. I asked. Brill.
Is that a word?
I asked Magnus, a 14-year-old. I was like, is brill a word? And he texted back, please stop.
Yeah.
No.
But we wanted to get a license plate, personalized license plate for the car, and we wanted touch on our lightning mobile.
Having Louise Glick in the car was not enough.
She looked it up and down, and it was Louise Glick moment when she got in.
You got the license plate? You did?
Well, touch was taken.
No.
So we got touch two.
Oh, love it. Love it.
All right.
Okay. This whole time, though, I've been waiting for you to tell me, because I've been asking, like, who did you paint it with? I thought you were going to tell me that you painted the lightning bolt with Louise Gluck.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that would have made the story.
That would have been amazing. No, she just kind of raised an eyebrow at the crudely drawn lightning bolt. But she was, it was wild being in classes with all these poets. And I took a workshop with Seamus Heaney, too. So that's around when these poems kind of happen.
And so Seamus wasn't like a one-day visitor. It was like you had a semester with Seamus?
Yeah. I mean, he is a great poet and a unforgettable teacher, but he didn't get like up in your stuff that much. Yeah. You know, he had other things going on. It was kind of more like benign neglect.
You didn't take him to the grocery store or anything?
I didn't take Seamus
to the grocery store.
In the Hornet.
For the best.
But we got to have a drink with him at the end of the term. He took us all to the pub.
And so these are written somewhere in that?
In that period, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so this first one is called A Thousand Cuts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
And I remember like trying to figure out if I should like type out the word.
It's a great question.
You know, 1,000 or, you know.
What did you go with?
I went numerical with a comma after the one.
Okay.
We shot lepers at dawn, shuffling with tin bells that clanked a warning of approach. 11 heads hooded and bowed in documentary fashion. They provided counterpoint to my voiceover. Many were lost on the floor of a Bombay editing room. The rest, I imagine, saved for the festivals.
Yeah.
Wow. It's
whatever.
Yeah.
Why even do it?
It's just
they're always so good. Amazing.
They are so good. Yeah, so when you...
Well, I have some bad ones here.
That one was good.
Yeah, here's a question. When you see that now...
Yeah.
Are you... I mean, I think any of us, you see something you wrote in the past and you sort of cringe and then... Whatever, but reading it, hearing it now, it sounds amazing to me. What do you feel? Like, are there things in there where you're like, oh, that's actually pretty cool?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I feel a little embarrassed at, you know, because I feel like I'm like totally like doing the Indian, you know, travel witness kind of thing, right? And I'd been in India the summer before with my family, sulking in the backseat of the ambassador car while they're driving, like, you know, endlessly. And I'm just like reading, like, so random what you read when you're in the backseat of the car with your parents. I was reading Sophie's Choice, the William Styron novel.
Yeah. Long. Great, wait, and so what year was this?
That was probably the summer after my senior year of high school.
But like what year?
No, summer after my sophomore year. I went to India with my parents, yeah.
So like in human time, what year?
So
world
in the Anno Domini.
World historic.
Yeah. That must have been 91.
Oh, yeah. Wow, okay.
And I remember I saw a boulder on the side of the road. We're driving through like the south of India, the state of Andhra Pradesh, which is very arid and long stretches of road. And we're going to Hyderabad to visit some family. And I saw a boulder that had a kind of spray painted on it, or painted on it, leprosy is curable. And I remember kind of feeling like, holy crap, wow, like there's leprosy? You know, I thought that was like from the Bible. And also it's like, why are you writing that in English to people who don't read that? Like, it was just a really strange mystery and a sad one.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where kind of that poem came from, you know. But then I guess I imagined myself as a documentary filmmaker. Like, I had to, you know, do some kind of grandiose fantasy of, you know.
Right. I mean, we have to, like, write. You weren't old enough yet to have.
I'm glad I didn't try to speak in the voice of a leper, you know. Like, it could have been a lot worse. But, you know, I think I see a kind of self-romanticization as like someone who is like the world-weary documentary filmmaker.
Yeah, but you gotta do that. It's the step we all have to take. You're not gonna skip that step. I don't think anyone can, right? You need that hubris to get to the next level.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's interesting to me. They're just. Not to say that you haven't advanced as a writer, but there is something in the voice here and in the narrative structure, at least within this particular poem, that reminds me a lot of elements of your first book in terms of this observational speaker, documentarian or not, that is sort of in a place that they are trying to think through what those surroundings are and how they relate both to the self and this sort of globally. And it relates to sort of travel. And it seems like those thoughts were circling around your head have been circling around your head maybe for a long time.
Yeah. Feeling like I think there's a kind of feeling helpless before kind of some mysteries. Yeah. You know, that I think is there in this poem that I do feel still kind of like animates a lot of, you know, what brings me to write. And I hadn't thought of that, you know, and I wouldn't think of that. And I also think like I tried out a lot of, and probably one reason why this made it out of the shoebox of shame,
you know, love it.
Is because I did see something, you know. That I connected to. And I've got stuff that I totally don't feel any connection to at all. And I think that one thing I learned by going through the shoebox of shame was that it's definitely not a linear journey.
Interesting.
You know, there are places where I was like, I was really lost.
My poetry got so bad when I got in the workshop because everyone else's poetry was inspiring mine. So every poem that I was handing in was like, oh, this is a Ben Gawker style, or oh, this is a Danny style. You know, like I lost any sense of what my style was. And that, for even years.
But that Danny style one was awesome.
Yeah.
Danny style one was.
So how do you think you got lost? Like, what was happening to you in those periods?
Okay, so I've got, like, the perfect poem.
Oh, all right.
Yes.
So this is the last in here, because this is one I wrote in the workshop when I was lost and I was doing, you know, Ben Dollar style and Matt Miller style and, you know, trying to, you know.
So just for clarity, are these other poets in the workshop? Or,
yeah.
Or, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And you guys were here at the same time?
We overlapped by a year.
But okay. I was here as an undergrad.
Yeah, I remember.
Yep. And Dan Beechiquick was my one of my teachers and Robin Schiff. And so I knew you, but I didn't have you as an instructor. But all of those names too.
Yeah.
And you guys were all in battle with each other, it seemed like.
Well, I was just like ducking and like watching, you know.
Well, I remember that you and Dan Beechiquick were in battle over squash and Scrabble.
That's true.
Interesting.
If battle is like being totally dominated by another human being.
I don't know. It seemed even to me.
Yeah, no. Yeah,
I wouldn't want to play either one of you in Scrabble, for sure.
Or squash.
Yeah. There's no competition.
Really?
Including in podcasting, because I listened to Dan's podcast and I was like, oh my God, I can't do this now.
No, it's all right.
It's so beautiful.
We'll delete his.
Good. Yeah, nobody listened to Dan's podcast.
Just
okay, so okay, I've got my response to that problem, right? Because I'm in my second year at the workshop and I still can't find my way to who I want to be as a writer. And so I wrote Game of Death. Oh. Hi. Prepare to defend yourself. My name is Srikanth Reddy. Your monkey technique is good, very good. But I'll show you real dragon kung fu. Nice kick. Now take that and that. Slowly, the human face appears through the speculative tradition in verse. You fought well, master.
You know what I hear in that is you're funny. Like, you're a very funny person, I feel like. And you're writing this sort of comedic stuff when you're in high school.
That's true.
I mean, I just read your first collection this morning. And I've heard you read, you know, so Underworld Lit, I've heard you read a little bit of that. It's very sort of beautiful and probing and exploratory and existential. But it's also very funny, you know, in places. And do you feel like at this point you're just sort of trying to figure out how to balance that deep documentary, exploratory, serious part of yourself with obviously this other sort of part of yourself that is a little bit lighter, a little bit funnier?
Just a total jackass.
Do you think that's part of what's happening, or that's just slapdash diagnosis? But like...
I think one thing, like that poem felt kind of good to write.
You had to write it.
Yeah, and like at the Foxhead later that night, like people were kind of like, oh, that was totally funny. But that was just jackassing around.
Right.
But I mean, it's great that you have a place to put jackass on the paper and not get in trouble and try it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I think that poem that you just read, if that wasn't written, some of these wouldn't happen.
I don't know. I feel like there's a little bit of that flippant, very funny part of yourself that maybe was turned up to 12 on this.
Yeah. And, you know, but I thought of it because you were talking about like trying on different styles and, you know, there's like kind of like, you know, and there's a way in which, I mean, I was also like super into martial arts when I was a kid. As a spectator, you know, and, you know, there's this like kind of like movie trope of the pupil who has to learn the different styles of like dragon style or mantis style. And there's a little bit of that, you know, when you're in writing school too, with different teachers and you try and learn mantis style.
Mantis style is the most popular one.
Yeah, because you get to like eat your mate's head.
It's interesting also that you said you turned this poem in for workshop and then you like went to the Foxhead and people were like, whoa, that poem's totally great.
It's totally great. Well, like,
I felt like I had a moment in the workshop where I was also floundering, trying to figure my voice out. And at one point I didn't have anything to turn in for workshop. So I turned in an email that I had written.
Wow.
And I feel like that was the one where suddenly everybody was like, oh, that poem you turned in, like that was really, it was really different. Like they were yeah. saying things that maybe it had humor in it. And it was the one where I was like, well, wait a minute. That was mm-hmm. the, like, that was
what
the one.
Doing
yeah. And yeah. it made me start thinking about maybe the ways in which I was trying to emulate what I thought was a good poem. And when I had kind of gotten that out of my head and I was just writing, it seemed in some way connect to an audience in a different way. And so I spent time after that thinking, I don't know, I guess what I'm getting at is after writing this, do you feel, and looking at it now, do you feel like it did shift maybe what you thought was possible for yourself as a writer?
Mm. I think it felt like cathartic. You know, I think it felt like when you're starting out as a writer, what's the Blake quote? You know, better strangle an infant in the crib than nurse unacted upon desires. You
know, oh, yeah, that
the marriage of heaven and hell is
that
it?
Very or? Popular quote we all know.
Yeah,
the one that I will never forget.
Yeah, it's you know, it's like you can't unhear that. You know, but I think that in writing school, that is actually like a proverb that you know should kind of listen to, and so I was thrown a lot at the wall, and you know, I didn't have a sense of a center as a writer, and I was having a lot of fun. I was meeting people who were coming from a place that felt like a real place, and feeling kind of crappy also about not feeling like I had that place or the place that I had, which was maybe writing about India or, you know, about those questions we were talking about earlier, wasn't, I felt like maybe I wanted to disown it. It wasn't the most exciting place that I saw poetry coming from. So I think that this was part of, you know, just trying something and that is a good thing to do. I mean, there's more embarrassing ones.
But it's like there's a courage there too that I think that I've seen in a lot of our interviews where there is like a type of moxie to try these things. And I think you have to have that to get over the hump of being self-aware or not knowing what you're doing. You know what I mean? Like, did you feel at any point like I am a writer, or did you feel like I'm pretending to be a writer?
I felt like I was pretending the whole time that I was, in school.
Do you feel like a writer now?
I don't know. Not yet. I don't think so.
Any day now.
But if you went back to yourself, right, in elementary school, writing the Abraham Lincoln poem, a classic, and introduced yourself now, I mean, you could say, like, we're doing it. We are a writer now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would feel like I got the elbow patches and the bike,
yes.
You know.
More than that, I think.
But, you know, I mean, I think every time I sit down to write something, I feel totally haunted by, is this real? Is this really poetry? Yeah. And I see it happening all around me, you know, and I love it when I see it. And I see little moments of it in things I've written, but I also see where, like, I feel like I'm kind of faking it till I make it to get to those places in the writing, too. And sometimes I feel like when I look at my first book, I feel like, oh, I like that the most, you know?
Yeah, that's so weird, too. I'll look back at stuff and be like, you were better then.
Yeah. But it's, like, kind of comforting, too, in a nice way.
Jigu, since you're here in Iowa City, and since we were referencing this a little bit, so you're at Harvard as an undergrad, you then come to Iowa City to get your MFA.
Yeah.
What was your time in Iowa like?
It was amazing. One of the things I like about living in Chicago now is that I can come to Iowa City sometimes and see friends and be in, and just touch ground, you know, because it's still really a place where people can be creative together. And that's really rare. And there's all kinds of things that are hard about it and all kinds of things that are, you know, I can understand why you could feel trapped sometimes in the intensities of this place. But it's also like it's really unique. And you know, since I left Iowa, I've visited like different like writing communities and different artistic and different schools and places. But I always keep coming back to this place, and I think it's that it's a place that brings people together, and some people stay and keep building, and some people come and go, and it's always being re-fed by young people coming through. And I think they probably keep you, you guys look pretty young, you know, like, it, you know, it keeps you on your toes if you live here.
So I'm curious, Chiku, so when I was listening to this interview with you, which took place a couple of years ago, I think in 2020, you were talking about how, I think what you were saying is that when you're writing now, you don't, you're not writing short lyric poems. At the time, you're saying you were doing something different. And so I'm curious now, like when you sit down to write, what's sort of happening now? Is there, are you, is there any particular project or sort of direction you're going in? Is there something that you're particularly focused on or obsessed with? Or this is usually Danny's question, but I'm stealing it.
So I have started to finally maybe try and come to terms with the running away from the problem of writing about my parents and my culture, that I like desperately didn't want to get boxed into as a high school student or a college student or even as a young writer. And then, you know, now I feel like looking back at that poem, you know, about the lepers and remembering that stuff, you know, I do realize it's been there somewhere for a long time. And now I'm thinking about writing a long kind of adaptation of the Indian epic, which is called the there are two great Indian epic. One is called the Ramayana and one is called the Mahabharata. And the Mahabharata is the longer of the two. It's kind of like the Iliad and like Ovid's Metamorphoses kind of put together. It's got a lot of stories and a lot of mythology, and it's got a, like a giant war in the middle of it. And there's no version in English that readers go to that isn't like kind of semi-scholarly. Or there is a version by a British poet named Carol Satyamurthy that is the closest, but I wanna kind of like go back there because those are the stories that like I did kind of grow up
on. So do you mean you would like to translate it or sort of write another version of it, or how do you envision
that? I think, you know, so there are translation projects at like, you know, the Clay Sanskrit Library at Columbia University and the University of Chicago has like teams of like distinguished Sanskritists who are trying to translate the whole thing, kind of literary English. They keep like dying or retiring, you know, it's just like, it's just such a long poem. It's like eight times the length of the Iliad and the Odyssey put together. So no way am I going to translate it, but I want to adapt it and probably like, you know, I'll have to leave a lot out, but you know,
we should do a comic book.
There is a comic book.
Is there a graphic novel?
That was how I came to it, is these comic books that were produced in India called Amar Chitrakatha that tell all of these stories. And so my uncles would bring those comic books over from India in their suitcases along with saris for my mother or mango pickle that would break and then spill all over the comics and, you know.
We had pickled mango. It's also an Iraqi food.
And I didn't know that.
They would ship it to us. And so when I was growing up, I was so embarrassed of the, it's such a fragrant smell.
Yeah, it really is.
And so whenever my dad would open it, I would be so embarrassed of, you know, you were talking earlier about sort of looking different or sounding different. And my family spoke a different language. And so just like the pickled mango is like a thing that I was so embarrassed about, and I still like am haunted by it. And yet,
do you like it?
I don't eat. I like have an aversion to it because of the embarrassment it gives me.
Yeah, yeah.
But like all of my friends in high school thought it was so cool. And love it, and like my wife loves it, and I just, it's one of those things that the minute you say it, I have like these visceral memories of the jar in the fridge and wanting to like hide it.
You got to do an episode where Danny just eats The mango pickle.
Well, we're going to do that. We're
going to
do the Danny episode one of these days.
I had one sort of final question I wanted to ask, which may take us in a different direction, and we can cut it if we want. But you were talking earlier, way at the beginning of this, about language, and I was just curious, what is the native tongue of your parents?
They speak a minor language spoken by only about 60 or 70 million people worldwide, called Telugu.
Okay. And did they speak it to you and your sister growing up?
Not really. You know, they were of a generation that thought that if you spoke your native language, that it would interfere with your kids learning English. Did you have that same
exact thing? Same thing with my parents? And so I'm curious, because you also talked about their you were focused on sort of mastering this language, which clearly maybe they didn't have for a variety of reasons. So now, as you've sort of grown up, are you interested in that language? Like, are you trying to connect to it in different ways?
Yeah. So, like, I think that's an interesting thing about becoming a poet too, or like becoming interested in language in a really crazily intense way when you're little, is my parents and your parents probably too used their language as a secret language.
100%.
And when they didn't want you to understand what they were talking about, when they were quarreling or, you know, talking about you, they would switch.
Yep.
And you would listen really carefully, you know, and you could maybe learn a little bit, you know, but not enough.
The thing that I often tell people, so my dad, his first language is Arabic, and he and my mother met in Israel, and so they speak Hebrew. That's kind of how they communicate often together. And so similar to what you're saying, ever we'd be around the family kitchen table and they want to switch into something, they would just start speaking Hebrew. But Arabic was even less something that I heard until we were talking with our extended family. So the reason I bring all this up is because while you could maybe think a little bit about how would you understand what's going on, you can always tell when someone's angry, no matter what language.
This is true.
Right. So when they switched into Hebrew or Arabic, I could start to tell when somebody was upset. And then I realized I have no idea the word. I'm just like watching their face or their, you know, hand gestures.
Yeah.
It's like Robert Frost says about The Sound of Sense, like, you know, that you can hear, like, if you read a poem and you listen to it, the sound of it, sense has a sound, you know, and you can hear it through a closed door, and you can hear the sound of the sense even when you can't hear the words, right?
Yeah.
One thing I learned, and so I started to study it a little bit in graduate school, and I went to India and I spent 7 weeks living in like a business traveler's hotel that my uncle owned, taking language classes at the University of Andhra, and I learned enough that I could get or travel backpack around a little bit. But I also learned that, like, my parents are foul-mouthed.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
Right?
So with all that, the very last thing I was going to ask is just, so then do they read your work now?
You know, just enough to, like, figure out that, like, I smoke.
Yeah.
But they're like, my father has never read a novel.
In English or
in
just
any
a novel?
Language. Yeah, yeah. And I learned that about him recently. You know, for him, literature was never a thing growing up in his village. And then, you know, and so, like, it's another world that I live in from them. And I'm grateful to them for, like, letting me go, you know.
Are they proud of you now? Do you catch them, like, bragging? After they were so worried about you becoming the guy with the patches on the bike?
Do they know what the Paris Review is?
Have they heard of it?
They don't really. They're like, oh, this is a that's that magazine. Is it in Paris? They've never looked through the magazine. No. But, you know, it's great to, there's also freedom of them not reading what I write or glancing at it a little bit, or just, you know, and I, you know, I dedicate my books to them, and, you know, and I'm glad that they don't read every word and that they're not like criticizing my poetry or feeling hurt by it or I think they're just glad that like I make a living.
Right on.
Yeah, for sure. Chiku, thank you so much.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Magid Center for Writing, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate College. We'd like to thank the Center for Language and Culture Learning for use of their podcast studio. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writinguniversity.org/podcasts to see our full list of offerings, including Writing Matters, The 11th Hour, Origins, The Short Coat, and more.
All right. Wait. Why are you playing the drums?
Because I was going to do a commercial.
Oh. What was your commercial?
Hi, listeners. We know that you're a fan of this podcast, but did you know that we have other podcasts on the Writing University Podcast Network? They include the Summer Writing Festival podcast, Writing Matters, and...
I got to tell you, if I was listening to this, we're
burning time.
I would not want to listen to those podcasts.
Let's get back into it.
Okay.
You have a whole podcast ecology,
I guess
you could call it.